Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
I do want to acknowledge that Chaucer's Old Middle English was rendered into modern English by A.S. Cline. The English that Chaucer wrote is probably closer to Old Norse than it is to modern English, and Old Norse is a difficult language too. Almost as difficult as modern English. Just one of the things that makes it challenging to talk about love. Like many words in our language, it has many meanings and many uses. And most of the time when I mention love from this pulpit, I am talking about love as solidarity, as embodying some sort of grand ideal of love in our relationships with others, in embodying that sense of universal and all-inclusive love that is the heart of the universalist half of the Unitarian Universalist tradition. But I should say that neither Unitarians nor Universalists have anything against love as personal and emotional. In fact, there are great love stories and romances in our tradition. Margaret Fuller and Count Basali, Louisa May Alcott's crush, never requited, on Henry David Thoreau. William Ellery Channing and his wife and the sadness of losing their son to illness. Both of Ralph Waldo Emerson's marriages are great romantic stories. And certainly Elizabeth Cady Stanton and her long marriage and seven children while being a leader of the suffrage movement. Unitarians and Universalists have nothing against personal and emotional romantic love, and these stories are as good as the stories of heroism that we tell much more often. Well, the word love does have many meanings. It has theological meanings, it has ethical meanings, and it has personal meanings. It is a large concept. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote of love, and I quote, "Love is a vital essence that pervades and permeates from the center to the circumference, the graduating circles of all thought and action. Love is the talisman of human weal and woe, the open sesame to every soul." More recently, the scholar Diane Ackerman wrote in A Natural History of Love, "Everyone admits that love is wonderful and necessary, yet no one can agree on what it is." So this morning I speak of love as a personal matter. And to do this, I will use four types of love identified in ancient Greek philosophy that still affect how we think about love today, that are still useful concepts. The first is agape, the love of God for all of God's creatures, reflected in love and community by what was known in early times as the love feast, which is also named agape in Greek. Eros, passionate and romantic love, one of the names of the ancient deity also known as Cupid. And then there's philia, which is love between friends. And storge, the love of children, parents, and other relatives for each other. A generous understanding of agape is at the heart of universalism, the love that leaves no souls out. This is a common way of identifying that ancient concept. And when I speak of solidarity, I speak of a humanistic, all-embracing love, which to me is the logical historical development of agape. And that is all I'm going to say about agape today, because today love is personal. Eros, philia, and storge are all ways of thinking about love in a personal way. And I can tell you something about all three of these by telling you a personal story. January last year, in Tampa, Florida, where it was warmer than it was here, I just strolled from the Apple store in the shopping center there to my car, having one of those adventures that frustrates even people who love the Apple software and hardware, dealing with the Apple store. And I got into the car. I was about to leave the parking lot when my cell phone rang with a number from Massachusetts that I didn't recognize. I took the call. "This is Tara, Ralph's daughter." I tried to remember when I had last seen her. Probably when she was a child, and I knew she was married and had children now. I'd heard that from her father and mother. "Yes," I said, "how are you?" And Tara said, "My father died on Monday, and my mother told me I had to track you down and tell you." And that's what she did. And found my cell phone number. Because truth be told, her parents were terrible about keeping track of phone numbers and addresses. And she found me in Tampa. Well, Ralph and I had known each other since the first grade. And his middle-aged daughter, herself now the mother of three and a public health nurse, and a bit of a tech wizard in her own right, had called to tell me that her father had died just a few weeks shy of his 65th birthday. In all the years we'd known each other, Ralph and I had shared many adventures, including with one of our other friends who was African-American riding around the other friend's mother's T-Bird to affluent white neighborhoods in Fairfield County and asking people working in their yards where the new black family, the Johnsons, had just moved in. It is amazing we got out of Norwalk, Connecticut alive. Ralph and I and another friend, Tim, played together in what we called the William Henry Harrison Memorial Jug Band. Figuring naming a jug band was appropriate since he was the president who died within a month of taking office because he insisted on giving a two-hour inaugural address in the pouring rain and contracted pneumonia. Our musical career was only a bit longer. And then there was the road trip to Michigan for our friend Tim's wedding. As we were heading out the door to get on the road, Ralph told his father and mother, "Oh, by the way, I've dropped out of college." And out the door. And lots of adventures since. And Ralph had met his wife, Sally, at my first wedding in 1971. She was a very good friend of Maureen, my first wife. And I had already met Sally before Ralph did. But that sparks flew that day, and it was what Ralph would later refer to as lust at first sight. Now, Ralph and I hadn't seen each other much during the last 20 or 25 years, but we were still friends. Our lives had gone in divergent directions, but our history together in friendship still framed our lives. And indeed, it was I who had called Sally a few months earlier to tell them that Maureen had died. When I spoke with Sally that day, after her daughter had called me, she told me that Ralph loved me. She also told me in great detail about the day Ralph died, which was that Monday. It was Martin Luther King holiday. And Ralph, who loved Christmas, had been putting off taking down the decorations. He had two grown daughters and five grandchildren, and he just loved Christmas. He loved singing Christmas music. He did a lot of Renaissance music. He sang with the Boston Lyric Opera. But he loved Christmas decorations, and he had promised Sally that he'd take the decorations down on the holiday. And he got up and said, "I don't feel like taking down the decorations. Let's go to the casino." Now, what proceeded was a day when she lost her $100 completely and he left with $500. And then they went out to the famous Chinese restaurant, bought way too much food, and took some of it home with them. Then they lit up some joints and hopped into bed. And after a day that included gambling, food, drugs, and sex, he had a massive heart attack and died. As his widow said, not a bad way to go. Well, I remembered my friend using that phrase, lust at first sight, and they had 44 years of lust together. Eros, but also very deep emotional commitment. You don't last 44 years as a couple without that. In fact, they eventually got married about 10 years ago when the kids were grown. Parenting, love of children, and doting on grandchildren. So parenting and the way couples develop adds, I think, a level of philia to eros. You can't last as a couple unless you're also friends. And of course, the storge. And of course, the philia with friends. Friends who live close by and friends at a distance. Love. It's personal. It's also complicated. Now, Valentine's Day, first and foremost, is about Eros. It is named for a saint or possibly two saints of the Catholic Church about whom so known is little that they were demoted from the liturgical calendar in the 1960s. So they're actually no longer saints. The symbol is a chubby little being named Cupid with wings. Cupid. There's a noun, cupidity. It has two meanings. One is greed and the other is lust. That's Cupid, the Roman god of love. But romantic love isn't just about lust, though that may indeed where it starts. Romances that begin with desire also develop commitment and affection that is emotional as well as physical. Love that transcends whatever physical attraction there is at the start of the relationship and the changes and often decline that come with the years. How else would another friend of mine, Charles, at age 80, lavish care and attention on his wife of more than 50 years as she slides slowly but steadily into dementia? Love can indeed be strong as death, as the poets say, and fragile at the same time, for it doesn't always last. I know, I've been divorced. Some of us have to learn how to get it right. Mae Sarton, a Unitarian Universalist poet and lesbian who had a long-term relation for decades, wrote a lot about love, its joy and its challenges. One of her poems is one of my favorites, and it's simply titled Love. Here it is. Fragile as a spider's web hanging in space between tall grasses, it is torn again and again. A passing dog or simply the wind can do it. Several times a day, I gather myself together and spin it again. Spiders are patient weavers. They never give up. And who knows what keeps them at it? Hunger, no doubt, and hope. Hunger and hope. Sartin wrote elsewhere in an essay, "Love opens the door into everything, as far as I can see, including and perhaps most of all the door into one's own secret and often terrible and frightening real self." Loving another person enables us and demands of us that we know ourselves and be the best self we can be. Or as Iris Murdoch put it, love is the extremely difficult realization that something other than oneself is real. Very real. When I officiate at a wedding, although I give the bride and groom, or the bride, or the groom and groom a lot of say in how the ceremony is worded, I often offer three pieces of advice. The first is to expect the best of each other, but don't expect perfection. And I go on and on about that for a while. And then I say, expect the best of yourself, but don't expect perfection. And remind them that I have noticed people are harder on themselves for something than their partner is. Because sometimes our own faults are too visible to ourselves, and other people don't think they're that serious. But also expect the best to come in the years ahead as you grow together. Because whatever impulse brings two people together, it's living together and learning together and growing together that makes the commitment last. So how do two people keep their love alive through the challenges of life, the challenges of work and parenting, the fading of eros and perhaps even of health? Often by being friends as well as lovers, having philia as well as eros. The journalist Robert C. Maynard, the late owner of the Oakland Tribune, wrote about this in a column about his parents. Who worked together in their own business. I mean, talk about putting pressure on pressure. Not only being married, raising a family, and running a business together. You know, it's like, when do you get a break? Well, he asked, why did they have this marriage that lasted for decades and decades and decades? And he wrote in a column, "The special ingredient, I believe, was friendship. My parents were not head over heels romantics. In fact, they were rarely demonstratively affectionate around us. But they were friends, best friends. That, I believe, was the great secret of their devotion. For a time when I was in high school, my father did some remodeling that required me temporarily to give up my room for an anteroom to my parents' bedroom. That is when I discovered what good friends they were. Long into the night, especially on weekends, they would talk about the doings of the previous day, the funny things that happened to one or another of them. The thing I noticed was the calm, even tone of their voices. They talked almost in a code of their own. They laughed at each other's silly mistakes and foibles. And when they disagreed about something, there was an odd silence. They listened very carefully to each other until each understood the reason for the argument of the other. Later, I was to learn that most people who argue have ceased listening to what the other person has to say. My parents were the opposite. My father once explained to me why he listened so carefully to my mother's arguments. "I always learn something by listening to your mother." He was by no means a docile person. He often argued back just as vigorously. But they never raised their voices to each other, And they clearly expected each other's views, clearly respected each other's views on just about everything. One clue as to how relationships last for a lifetime. Now, Maynard's story is about how in the 20th century his parents made real the promise of the ancient Hebrew Song of Songs or Song of Solomon, where it says, "Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If one offered for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly scorned." It was by recognizing that love, even between a married couple, may start with eros, but it is more than eros. I could say that romantic love matures into romantic friendship, eros and philia both. And as families combine and mature with each other, there is storge as well. You should see sometimes how my wife moves around amongst my cousins, whom she's only known for a dozen years or less. And even my sisters, who are like sisters to her now after 14 years of marriage. It sort of developed. The family extends itself. There's also the story of my friends Ralph and Sally and how their relationship developed over decades. And also another couple I've known for over 20 years, Carmen and Pinto, Carmen and Jackie. A same-sex couple who've been together for over 20 years. They live in my neighborhood. And Friday evening, I ran into them at the Chinese takeout place nearby. Well, I didn't actually run into them in the takeout place. I recognized their license plate on the car in the parking lot, so I looked in the stores as I was going to the drugstore to see which one they were in, because I hadn't seen them for a while. And there they were getting takeout, because they're about to drive from West Orange to Edison to their daughter Destiny's concert at Edison High. She is an outstanding jazz bass player at age 14. And these are two people who have just built an incredible relationship with multiple layers over decades and adopted children and raising them. It's also Jody's and my story of having multiple layers to the relationship, the possibilities of which became clear on our first actual date when she made a joke about Marx's description of the rentier class in the book Capital. Now, that's not a rip-roaring joke for most people. And if I told it to you, it would go over most of your heads because, you know, even most educated people don't read much of Marx or of Adam Smith on the other end of the economic spectrum. You know about them, you don't read them. You don't need to know what Marx said about the rentier class in Capital, but here was a joke. Someone who knows the Marxist canon and has a sense of humor. That is even rarer than people who've actually read Marx. And we still have conversations of that sort and puns that draw on the fact that we both had 4 years of Latin in high school. It's amazing how much Latin you can forget in 50 years, but also how much you can remember if it gets thrown at you in the right form. Now, this morning, I could have given you a scholarly discussion of love. I actually looked at some philosophical references on love and how love was understood in philosophy and other cultures. And I'll tell you, the philosophical stuff was totally uninspiring, dry as dust. Poetry works better on this. I also could have taken 10 minutes to explain Jody's joke in painful intellectual and historical detail. I'll just give you a clue that there's a Unitarian involved in it, other than the two of us. There are vast religious, philosophical, and sociological and psychological literatures about love. And some of them are worth reading for reasons other than telling personal stories. There's stuff I've read is really helpful in the work I do in counseling people, whether preparing to be married or dealing with problems in their relationships. And I could have linked eros, philia, and storge to agape in a clever intellectual construct. But not even Plato or Aristotle tried to do that. So how can I have managed to pull that one off? Instead, I've used these to frame some personal and even quirky stories and reflections on love, and kept it personal. I hope I've cheered your hearts.